On a rainy afternoon in January, I popped into a recording studio in London's Soho district to sit down with Kate Ashton and Michael Granoff, two people who know arguably more about the secondaries market than anybody on this planet. Ashton is a partner at law firm Debevoise & Plimpton and was there in person, and Granoff is CEO and founder of Pomona Capital, a secondaries firm, and he was dialing in from a studio in New York. I chose to kick off this podcast series about the last decade of the secondaries market with Ashton and Granoff for three main reasons. Both were executing on secondaries deals prior to 2014 and have seen firsthand how the secondaries market has grown over the years. They're also experts in their respective fields, Ashton structuring deals on the legal side and Granoff raising some of the market's earliest funds. On top of that, they're also just really nice people to speak to. 10 years ago, the secondaries market looked very different to how it does today. In 2024, the concept of an LP selling its stake in a private equity fund is nothing unusual. The stigma around secondaries sales has by and large disappeared, and secondaries trading in some private equity funds is so frequent that secondaries market participants have coined the term flow name to refer to funds that frequently appear on the secondaries market. But back in 2014, this was hardly the case. Annual trading on the secondaries market was around $26 billion. Institutional investors did not publish press releases highlighting that they had offloaded a portfolio of private market stakes on the secondaries market. Fund managers certainly did not advertise the fact that they were restructuring one of their funds. For us journalists, finding out information about secondaries trades was tiresome and challenging, but at least it was fun. 2024 marks a decade since Secondaries Investor launched. In that time, the secondaries market has grown by leaps and bounds. In 2014, private markets were still feeling the effects of the global financial crisis. The Volcker Rule came into effect that year, named after its architect, Paul Volcker, who was former chair of the US's central bank. It was a piece of financial legislation that essentially prohibited banks from investing in private equity with their own funds. It aimed to prevent such institutions from making the sorts of risky investments that preceded the financial crisis. I'm Adam Lay, a senior editor at PEI Group and editor of Secondaries Investor. Welcome to the Decade of Secondaries Investor. In this mini-series, we'll bring you on a journey into the biggest themes and developments in the secondaries market over the past 10 years. We'll look at how increasing specialization will drive future fundraising and deal volume. We'll examine how continuation funds have risen from relative obscurity to become one of the most preferred exit routes for some GPs. We'll look at why continuation funds containing one single asset are set to define the next iteration of the secondaries market's evolution. We'll look at how programmatic sales by LPs is playing an increasingly larger role in the LP portfolio market. And we'll find out how, 10 years on, regulation is still playing a crucial role in 2024 and beyond. Some of these episodes will be hosted by me. In others, you'll hear from my colleague Maddie Farman, a senior reporter on Secondaries Investor and PEI. This is episode 1, The Aftermath. Here's Kate Ashton and Michael Granoff talking about what things were like back in 2014.
So I guess I'd like to set the scene first. Maybe Kate, we can start with you. Could I ask you, maybe an odd question, but 10 years ago today in 2014, can you kind of remember what you were doing? What were you working on? What were the biggest things on your desk 10 years ago?
Well, we were probably working on secondaries, I'm sure I was, but we might not have called them that then. We certainly didn't call them GP-led secondaries. That term wasn't there. I think there was a great deal of concern about the Volcker Rule and what its impact would be because it had already been passed by Congress. But we hadn't really felt the implications yet 10 years ago today. I think we were very concerned about the aftermath of the GFC and what was going to happen. People were still recovering. I don't think some people, savvier business people than I am, may have foreseen the growth in the secondaries market. I think I would not have predicted it was as big and as important as it has been, but I think it was very clear that it was providing important liquidity, particularly at that point for distressed sellers, for GPs who weren't necessarily in distress, but may have had assets that needed longer runway. And I was working with my clients on very bespoke solutions, I think, for that kind of situation.
For Granoff, he says that in some ways what he and his firm are doing today is similar to what they were doing back in 2014. In other words, they look to reduce the risk in private equity via secondaries purchases.
We were looking to buy high-quality assets, not disturbed at troubled assets, but high-quality assets from investors who were motivated to sell. And if you then look at the situation 10 years ago, you just began to have some different reasons, different motivations why LPs may need liquidity. And one of the lessons that we learned pretty early on in the process was that for the most part, investors in private equity assets or funds, when they need to sell them, it's not really because of something having to do with the assets so much, but it's something having to do with them. And so when Kate referred to the GFC or referred to the Volcker Rule, these are all things that were not happening to the private equity assets themselves that people own, but these were things that were happening to the owners of those assets.
It's interesting to think about the concept of distress. Granoff says that secondaries firms typically buy non-distressed assets from sellers who are distressed in some way. That applies to both 10 years ago in the aftermath of the GFC and today. It's just that the distresses are different today. Interestingly, 10 years ago, when the secondaries market was just $28 billion in size, measured by annual trading, just 1% of the deal volume was defined as coming from quote-unquote distressed sellers. I'd like to make a quick side note point here, which is that it's probably pretty tricky to figure out if a seller is truly distressed or not. It's not like they're going to tell you their house is burning down and that they need to sell everything at fire sale prices. Not usually, anyway. Granoff points out that there typically aren't distressed sellers of private markets assets. They're better classified as motivated sellers. Looking back at the stories we published on Secondaries Investor in 2014, there's hardly an element of distress to the types of deals or fundraisers we wrote headlines about. In 2014, firms including J.W. Childs, Diamond Castle, Iron Bridge, and Motion Equity Partners ran what were then called fund restructurings. A team spun out from UniCredit, an Italian bank. Ardian, which had completed its own spin-out from French insurer AXA the previous year, raised $9 billion for its flagship private equity secondaries fund. And Singaporean sovereign wealth fund GIC and CalPERS, the US's largest public pension, both began developing strategies to interact with the secondaries market that year. So, was 2014 a turning point in the development of the secondaries market?
I think it was, and maybe it won't be too fulsome of me to say the very fact that Secondaries Investor was founded is a demonstration of that. There was suddenly, with your advent and excellent coverage, there was a lot more publicity being given to what people had been doing. And I mean, I was fortunate enough to be involved in several of those deals that you mentioned. And as I said in my opening remarks, things started out at that time being quite bespoke. They were often one-on-one negotiations between investors and the sponsor, trying to offload assets in the sort of what's now called the GP-led space. And even in the more traditional secondary space, there was a sense that secondaries had been somewhat illiquid and hard to find a buyer. And with the increased publicity, with the increased knowledge of the market, that fed on itself and led to outdoing some of the predictions that you raise there about 10% a year, because the more people realized that there were willing buyers and sellers, the more it allowed the market to develop as people started thinking, well, maybe I'll rebalance my portfolio, maybe I'll look for a buyer for this asset. It was sort of a virtuous circle that continued and grew and grew and grew.
I think that Kate's point about the growth of the market is an important one, because when I started doing this a very long time ago, it was a tiny, tiny part of the market. People didn't even know you could sell interest in private equity funds or private equity assets, because all of the legal documents that Kate put together basically said you couldn't in one way or another, right? And so it was a revelation to people that they thought they were locked up forever. And that's the document that they signed. And so they were surprised to see that actually there was some ability to get some liquidity. But at the same time, at the beginning, there was quite a lot of stigma, or at least apparent stigma, attached to selling. You know, people thought that no one would ever have lunch with you again or something like that. And GPs, you know, not the most ego-challenged group in the world, would say things like, well, you know, someone may sell an interest in your fund, but they'd never sell an interest in my fund, right? And, you know, what everyone realized over time was that if you managed enough money for enough people over enough time, there were going to be people that needed to sell, and it really wasn't about you.
No one would ever have lunch with you again if you sold a stake in a GP's fund. It's worth taking a moment to step back and think about just how far the secondaries market has come. It's fair to say that the stigma around secondary sales has well and truly disappeared, and that many an LP are still having lunch with existing, past, and potential GPs, to the tune of roughly $114 billion a year and counting. So, how did we get here? What happened over the past decade that facilitated the growth of secondaries trading in alternative funds? One major driver is the overall growth of the primary market, the size of which is now measured with a T and not a B, as Grenoff points out.
If you look at sort of the variables that determine turnover, you probably could put them into two broad categories. And in some ways, your question alludes to both. So some are secular changes, and secular changes, things like just people becoming more comfortable with the market, have steadily increased over time. And you'd say that's a pretty steady increase, that as people are more comfortable that they have a liquidity option, that people will have lunch with them the day after, people are more willing to transact. And the other, which has a more volatile nature to it, is probably cyclical factors. So people are affected by cyclical macroeconomic factors. And Adam, you've alluded to those too, like the GFC, like the Volcker Rule, like other things that have come in and affected sort of volatility of markets in a kind of a broad way. And so our market is also affected by those cyclical factors. And obviously when times are tougher, there are more sellers. And when times are not as tough, there are fewer sellers. And so there's a way in which you could probably look at our market in quite a academic context and kind of explain what's happened. But it's also true that the overall market has grown and become sort of a more established piece of the private equity firmament than I think it was certainly when we started, and it was even 10 years ago.
And if I could pick up on one point that Michael very correctly made, of course, it remains true. It was true then, it is true now, that a sale, a secondary sale, still requires the consent of the GP. So without being boringly legalistic, you're right in a sense that, yes, it's not open season to just buy and sell secondaries interests. You have to go back to the fund manager and get permission. And I think that's important because it goes to the psychology of all of this, that GPs were realizing that it wasn't necessarily a reflection on their fund. In fact, in most cases, it wasn't a reflection on their fund at all, that a seller might wish to sell because a seller needed capital or something, or, you know, coming for various other reasons. And therefore, I think the GP consents have become much easier to get, much more not taken as personally, much more a standard matter in the private equity market, where, of course, many people are return buyers and sellers and investors, and your market reputation and interaction with people are crucially important.
It certainly seems like something was changing in 2014. When I looked at the deal volume figures between 2013 and 2014, something certainly had changed. So, $27.5 billion in deal volume in 2013. The next year, $42 billion. That's a huge jump. I think perhaps one of the largest jumps we've seen over the past decade in terms of volume. What happened? Well, in short, a confluence of events happened to push deal volume up. It was the aftermath of the GFC, there was increasing regulation, and there was also lumpiness, as Grenoff points out. The secondaries business is a lumpy business. In other words, one year, several large trades may happen that increase deal volume. The next year, those large trades may be absent and deal volume goes down. On the regulation front, Ashton says this shouldn't be overplayed, but the Volcker Rule and Solvency II, Solvency II was a regulation affecting insurance companies and the percentage of risky assets that they can hold on their balance sheets. These played a big role. The market wasn't necessarily flooded with regulation-driven sales in 2014, but over a period of 5 to 8 years, on both sides of the Atlantic, regulation-driven sales played a big role. I asked Ashton and Grenoff what kinds of lasting impacts the increase in deal volume around that time have had on the development of the market over the past 10 years.
I think documentation became somewhat more standardized, and that in turn led to ease of completion of some of these complex transactions or multi-fund transactions. And people became more familiar with them. And as more entrants came into the market, more people became familiar. There came to be a cadre of advisors, legal, experienced lawyers, but also experienced bankers, and processes began to be put in place much more in those years.
It became more about choice and less about whether there was enough deal flow. And so, and I used to get questions about, so what keeps you up at night kind of thing, right? And I would say, well, you know, lots of things keep me up at night, unfortunately, but deal flow actually isn't one of them. Right. And so you began to see that dynamic, I think, where the overall amounts of deal flow from a depth and breadth point of view started to get big enough where it meant that the business model was more about choice and less about the macro deal flow.
A kind of snowball effect started to happen where investors saw the kinds of returns they could get from secondaries funds, leading to them wanting to commit more capital to the strategy, which in turn meant secondaries funds had more capital to invest, including in bigger deals.
I think that really affected the market over the last 10 years. Now, there's a huge amount of dry powder in the market, and even the largest transactions are not beyond the reach of the secondaries investors. If you look at the fundraising for secondaries investments, or for funds that had a portion of their capital allocated to secondaries investments, if not specifically, it definitely went up in this period because it was a good story. People were getting very, very good returns from at least the best funds.
One thing that's been integral to the growth of the market over the last 10 years has been institutional investors becoming more familiar with selling on the secondaries market. This is a topic that deserves its own episode, and it's one my colleague Maddie Farman will examine in a few weeks from now when we examine programmatic LP sales. Interestingly, Granoff's view is that press coverage had a role to play in growing the LP portfolio sale market, something that was clearly music to my ears.
If you look at the growth of the market, you know, there's a part of it that just started to get big enough so that people could participate. But you're also right that there was sort of headlines about it, that when some big, well-known institution decided to sell and then could sell in that way, did that get people's attention because people like you would write about it? Yeah, it was. And so you have a combination of sort of this undercurrent that's continuously growing. And then you have kind of news items like that where people said, really? I someone like CalPERS would sell. Boy, that's interesting. And, I'm facing some of the same pressures that CalPERS is. And maybe that's something I should look at. And maybe I have more choices than I thought I would have to do that. And maybe I can treat these assets the way I treat all the other assets I have. You know, and when I have an issue in any other asset class I have a liquidity option. And I didn't think I had one here, and now maybe I do. And so it's not that the situation's so different. Maybe it's that I should treat the assets the same way and look at it the same way. And so I think that that all those things did play a role, including, you know, well-known people selling that did create kind of headline knowledge, let's say, that were catalytic, I would say, in that way.
Of course, it seems all too easy to look back in hindsight and say, of course this market was going to grow and develop. In reality, there were challenges and setbacks.
Well, I think the secondaries market tends to stop and have to react when there's a crisis, a global or macro crisis, and there have been several in the last 10 years. And so there's always a bit of a lull until secondaries pricing catches up to the market and what has happened. So, for example, in COVID, I think there was a quiet period while the secondaries market came to terms with what had happened and factored in the effects of the pandemic into certain asset classes. And then, as we all know, it came back roaring. It was just a lull. And I think we've seen that several times in the past 10 years.
Looking forward to the next 10 years, I asked Ashton and Granoff how big they think the secondaries market could eventually get, and what is the biggest factor preventing the secondaries market's growth. Ashton pointed out the issue of capitalization, how much money is being raised for secondaries funds, as one of the biggest drivers of growth. This is an issue that multiple people we spoke to for this podcast series highlighted as the biggest challenge for growth. Ashton, who's one of the market's best-known legal minds, said it is possible that there will be increased regulation on either side of the Atlantic.
I don't expect something that would have a dramatic effect on the markets. And this regulation that we have seen so far, which I'm sure you're also talking about later in this podcast series, is really more correcting abuses and not affecting the fundamentals of the market. But it is possible that an ill-judged regulation, well, for example, the Volcker Rule, which wasn't originally intended to address private equity, but sort of caught private equity up into its whole remit, something like that could have a negative effect. But I'm hoping it won't. I think people recognize that this is a vibrant and important market.
You know, it's important to understand that this market is, while it has some advantages in being able to navigate difficult situations and be, let's say, insulated and not one-to-one correlated with what happens in the rest of the world, it's not uncorrelated. And so big macroeconomic things that happen affect our market as well, and they affect sellers and they affect investors in that way, and we are subject to them. And those factors can be sort of purely economic, in a sense, market crashes and all kinds of things like that. They can be geopolitical. That kind of unrest usually causes people to want to go to the sidelines one way or another. And certainly we have enough going on in our world that if you ask me what keeps me up at night, it may not be deal flow in the secondaries business, but the rest of the world, you know, keeps me up at night.
So it sounds like there are certain headwinds in particular areas, but I get the feeling that the secondaries market's growth is going to be up and towards the right. And who knows, in 10 years' time, we may be sitting back in the studio, all three of us discussing the $2 trillion secondaries market that we happen to be a part of. So I hope we can do.
And the increased success of Secondaries Investor.
I hope so too. Cheers to that.
In the next episode, we'll look at the growth of the continuation fund market and how more GPs came to use continuation funds over the past 10 years to hold onto prized assets.
These are marquee assets that, frankly, the GP knows well. They've owned it for 3 to 7 years, and they want more time because it's been a gift, and the gift keeps on giving.
That's Vern Perry, Global Head of Blackstone's Secondaries Business, talking about the rise of the continuation fund market on the next episode of the Decade of Secondaries Investor miniseries. The production editor on this miniseries was Evie Russman, and our audio editor is Eric Fish. For PEI and Secondaries Investor, I'm Adam Lay. Thanks for listening.